Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
A few weeks ago, Tim Penner, who is the most diligent newspaper reader that I know, brought me a story clipping that's kind of kept nipping at the heels of my thoughts. It turned out that something from that weekend's Free Press, Tim was like, this feels pretty apropos. I don't even remember what the talk bit was about, but there was a connection. But the article is titled, the headline is Societal Secularization in Spotlight, and the subtitle is Authors Say, so not the authors of the article, but the authors of the book under sort of review and interaction in the article setting. Authors say life without religion would go on pretty much as it always has. Now, John, the article's author in the Free Press is John Longhurst, John's occupational story strikes me as a bit of a canary in the coal mine story. I don't know if that's a familiar metaphor, but even for the purposes of people who might be joining us by podcast, when we say something is a canary in a coal mine, it's a metaphor for an early warning of danger, and the origin of the expression is literal. Canaries were historically, you put them in a cage and you lower them down into the mine to test for carbon monoxide and other toxic gases. A bit hard on the canaries, potentially, but of considerable benefit to the miners. John is probably best known here in Winnipeg as the faith reporter for the Free Press. And that's the context in which he wrote the article, and which we'll talk about more shortly. John also recently received the Order of Canada this past December, one of three Manitobans to do so. And that's an order that is given to people who have, and this is sort of the official language of the order, who have made extraordinary contributions to the nation. And the motto, in translation, is they desire a better country. And John was recognized, and this is from the Governor General's website about the award, so this was sort of his blurb. He was recognized for his efforts to, quote, promote positive interdenominational relations, to reduce hate, and to help readers see the humanity in every person. And it's pretty hard not to be on board with that from my perspective, although it does leave open, again from my perspective, questions about why we need religion at all, never mind competitive denominational or religious distinctives that might foster hate to such a degree that someone could meaningfully give their life to its reduction. To the canary in the coal mine part, John is also a religion reporter, so he's got the faith beat, to use his language, with the Free Press. He's also a religion reporter with Canadian Affairs, and in both those contexts, he is the last religion reporter in Canada. Right? John, should you by some wild chance ever hear this podcast, I was about to use the phrase a dying breed, but I reeled it in. To sort of put that into context, he's able to do that job in both settings because he goes out and raises the money that makes it possible. If you look at the faith page in the Free Press, you look at the slug right under that header, there's this text. It says, the Free Press acknowledges the financial support it receives from members of the city's faith community, which makes our coverage of religion possible. They don't have the budget for a faith beat or, as John says, a chess beat. Or, like, there's a number of things that there would have been a designated reporter for at certain points in this media's history that there no longer is, including faith. So he's, in both those contexts, he is the last one. Now, depending on your perspective, that could be a signal of some sort of danger, sort of a canary in a coal mine. To hold that perspective, that the fact that John's the last religion reporter in Canada, and that that's a problem, you would have to believe, at least to some degree, I think, that religion is essential to human well-being, to cultural well-being, and that reduced interest in it is a signal of, in some meaningful way, of a less good country. Those would be the kinds of beliefs that would underpin there being a last religion reporter as problematic. The measurable fact is that in this part of the world, fewer and fewer people hold that belief. I read a post-award interview with John, and in that interview, I was intrigued that he didn't hesitate to conflate religion and spirituality in terms of how the interview read. Those were synonyms. Now, that's in a context that notes at the end of the interview that it's been edited for length and clarity, and I have every confidence that John could also parse those two things with real skill and insight and empathy. But not everyone can, or at least not everyone does. There are millions of people who do separate religion and spirituality. We've often considered that in this space, people who identify as spiritual but not religious. And many of us would resonate with that. We would believe that you can be spiritual without being religious, and of course you can be religious without being spiritual, but they're not mutually exclusive. You could be religious and spiritual. John's article opens with this sentence: "The story of religion in Canada in the first part of the 21st century is about people leaving it." And then he follows that up with, quote, "As fewer and fewer people claim any religious adherence, what will happen to society?" So like any good journalist, he's posing the problem that he's going to speak to. And then he goes on to explore the claims of a new book that is called Goodbye Religion, The Causes and Consequences of Secularization, which essentially argues that nothing will happen. No societal collapse, no dramatic rise in crime, no huge fall in morality. The book's authors are a pair of American sociologists, Ryan Cragen and Jesse Smith, and they worked with a combination of over 100 interviews that they conducted and general social survey data and other U.S. data sources, and they found that when it comes to such things as, so these are some of their markers, such things as stealing, cheating on taxes, not paying bus fare, accepting bribes, and committing acts of violence. Maybe it's just the order in which they occurred, but I felt like the leap from not paying your bus fare to committing acts of violence was a significant one. In any case, those are the markers that they found with those kinds of things being measured. There's not a significant statistical difference between people who say they are religious, people who are not religious, and people who say they are atheists. In other words, from their vantage point as researchers and sociologists, a non-religious world would not be a catastrophe. On the other hand, they're also quick to say it wouldn't suddenly become a secular utopia. So they're not making the argument that if we could just do away with religion, everything would get better. They're making the argument that if religion disappears, things are not going to get worse. The authors say in the book, quote, "The truth lies somewhere in the boring middle," in that regard. And buried in the heart of the article is a sentence that I found quite encouraging. Longhurst writes that, quote, "Through the book, Cragen and Smith hope both religious and non-religious Americans," and he does make something at the end of the article about the cultural difference between the two contexts, "Cragen and Smith hope both religious and non-religious Americans will see they have more in common than they might realize." So that's the author's intent, if you will. That's their hope. They're not particularly concerned about what might happen in the future if religion ceases to be a major force in society. They basically say, and this is sort of language they use in the book, people that have that concern should, quote, relax, academic language, and, quote, refocus more attention on the many social problems we should be worried about, close quote. That's pretty interesting, at least to me. So basically, to return to the metaphor, we sent a canary that tests for whether the world might be fine without religion down into the mine, and it came back up singing the same song it was singing when it went down instead of being comatose on the floor of the cage. On the other hand, both the book's authors and Longhurst note the importance of common ground as a foundation for addressing the social challenges that need attending to. And in this series of Talky Bits dealing with this idea of ethics beyond religion, we've been exploring the notion that one significant aspect of that common ground that we might hold is an ethics of compassion. That's kind of been the ground that we've been returning to. And what I want to touch on today is the question of whether science, as I said I would, whether science might provide a substantial enough basis for such an ethic? It's an interesting question. As I said in the blurb, it's a big topic, short talk, but I'm going to just put a few ideas out there for us to go away and muse about. First of all, it feels important to me to acknowledge that advances in science are one of the big reasons for the decline in interest in religion. I've often said this in this space, but one of the reasons we humans make religions is because we have a shared drive toward making meaning. We value, I would say it stronger than that personally, I would say we need explainer stories. They're one of the very significant ways that we navigate the world. They help us deal with uncertainty and the fears that often follow in uncertainty's wake. And also, because we have bodies and we perceive a material world through our senses, explaining what we're experiencing, sensually, materially, is one of the main functions of these stories. That's, for example, that's why if we look at ancient mythologies, we always find story explanations for the weather. The rain gods didn't like our sacrifices, so the rains didn't come. The rains don't come, we don't eat. That's a big deal. We need an explainer story. Uncertainty, fear. How do we make meaning out of this? It's why when we saw historically, still, but in different ways, but when we saw human behavior that we found disconcerting, somebody wasn't sort of adhering to the cultural norms or means, we might have historically attributed that behavior to something spiritual, to a demon, right? So in the last couple of hundred years, which is a very small percentage of human history, we've experienced growing mastery over many aspects of the physical world. And broadly speaking, science has been the medium through which we've found that mastery. And the trajectory of that growing knowledge has been, continues to be, incredibly steep. The rate at which we are learning new things in the realm of science in general and related disciplines is staggering. It's also been one of the major factors that has led people to question whether we have any need for religions at all. And it's led many people to ask, either consciously or behaviorally, if science provides an explanation for the things we're wondering about, for the things we need explainer stories for, do we still need the stories that explain the same things with angels, demons, unseen realms, spirits, and so on? Do we still need stories that feature our imagined pictures and personifications of the divine? Let me move this into the realm of the personal for a moment. I have a surgery scheduled for tomorrow morning. It's day surgery, a minor procedure to remove a lump under my arm. I've spoken about this in this space before, but let me just put it to rest in case that wasn't something that you heard me mention. It's been biopsied. It's not cancer. Now, how do I feel about this? Well, I'm not a fan of pain, and I know the recovery process will include some of that. When a surgeon says you can expect some discomfort at the site for a while, that's... I could imagine choosing to be that vague if I was a surgeon as well. But so I'm not looking forward to, you know, the ouch part of this. I would say that my anxiousness level is at about a 3 or a 4. So there's nothing that's interfering with my ability to live my life, to focus on what I choose to focus on, although I would say it shows up as a little more distraction once in a while. But generally, I'm able to be present to others and so on. I've met the surgeon and their assistant. They did the biopsy. The surgeon seemed quirky but very competent. The assistant was competent both medically and socially, which helped mitigate some of the surgeon's quirks. Meaningful relationship there, I think. Quite symbiotic, actually. I feel confident in the biopsy results. I mean, they drilled 6 holes in that lump, so, you know, there's data. So I feel quite confident in the science, and I feel quite confident in the skills of the people involved, also science-based. I also know that there are people thinking of me as I go into this, and if they're so inclined, perhaps praying for me. Is that comforting? Yes, it is. Is it what I'm counting on to come out the other side in good repair? Well, I appreciate and value complexity, and I would also say that in this instance, I feel pretty clear that more of my comfort is coming from the science. I think it would be fair to say I'm trusting the medical science. I'm not looking for a miracle. I'm looking for a competent surgery. I don't think it's especially surprising that advances in science have led many people to a place where religious ways of explaining things feel antiquated and inadequate. They feel stuck in the past and in stories that can feel like they live in a realm that's detached or fantastical, and as a result, they've moved on. When we live in a world where the elimination or reduction of diseases, space travel, advanced computing, many other things we've only dreamt about have become reality, I don't think it's any wonder that many have come to place all of their hopes and confidence in science. That does not strike me as remarkable at all. I find it interesting to consider how many different stories can move into the space traditionally occupied by religion, be helpful in that space, and also misbehave in that space in similar ways. Science-based has become, or can become, as fundamentalist as faith-based or God says. It's a belief, right? It's a belief system. And it can behave for good and for ill like any other belief system. And that danger is one of the reasons I think it's important to acknowledge, among other things, that mystery grows right along with knowledge. I think that's a super important paradigm. I also think it's important to acknowledge the limits of whatever story we're leaning into. It makes sense to me that science has undermined some aspects of traditional religion, as I hope I just illustrate. What does not add up for me is when science has a similar effect on the need for spiritual or inner values. Well, we've been using the language of ethics for. That science would undermine many traditional aspects of religion? Gotcha. I don't need a weather god explanation for the weather when I have a scientific explanation for the weather. Fine. However, the scientific explanation for the weather in no way needs to mitigate my desire or need for spiritual or inner values. I want a competent surgeon. I also want an ethical one. I want a competent surgeon trained by the best science that there is and advise of it and current with it. I also want a surgeon who is compassionate, who is caring. Right? So I don't think that one of these science answers, science explainers, needs to mitigate spiritual or inner values or assail them, even though it may assail traditional aspects of religion, which is why I mentioned John's conflation of religion and spirituality. I think separating those pieces in our thinking is important. Also acknowledges that they interleave, but they're distinct from one another. And here I think we come to an interesting intersection. Increasingly, science is able to demonstrate and make a case for the benefits of inner or ethical values. Of particular interest to me is the overlap as it shows up sort of in the fields of physics, biology, psychology, and especially in the last few decades in neuroscience. As you all know, I am the opposite of an expert in any of those fields. More versed in some than others, but keep me clear of physics because that involves math, at least initially. But I'm a curious person. I find all of them interesting. So I kind of read at the popular level in all of those. And with that in view, I don't think it's an accident that some of the great contemporary systems of thought in those realms have also come from people whose worldview and values have been deeply impacted by the realms of mystery traditionally occupied by religion. Some really significant thinkers in the world of science have their ethic, their values, informed by things that we would use the language of spirit for. Lots of figures I could have picked for this. I'm going to pick one that I've sort of been bumping into off and on lately, Viktor Frankl, psychologist, neurobiologist, probably best known for his magnum opus, Man's Search for Meaning, which he wrote after being interred in concentration camps because he was also Jewish. But by the time he was interned, he was 37. He'd already had a full-blown career as a therapist and as a neurobiologist. How many of you have ever kind of even sort of in a cursory way read around Man's Search for Meaning? So the first half is kind of reflective. And the second half is about the modality, about his therapy modality, logotherapy, and quite technical at some points. But it's interesting that from the outside, people have assessed that his work around that modality, logotherapy, has been described as, quote, literally interlaced with quotations from authoritative Jewish forces, close quote, and breathing the very spirit of Judaism. Wait. It's science. So that's interesting to me. So this is a thinker who said that we can find meaning in life in three different ways. By creating a work or doing a deed, love that that's the first one on the list personally. What a great acknowledgement of our embodied reality, right? You want to make meaning? Go make it. Like, put your hands on it. This will be a bit of a paraphrase. I walk past this many times a day, but I don't have it burned in my head literally. But Dasha, a couple of Christmases ago, gave Corrine and I as a gift for our house a piece of artwork that's on the wall right in the entry of our home that says, if your hands find something to do it, do it with all your might. Say thank you and move on. Like, just make meaning. Actually make meaning. And the second is by experiencing something or encountering someone. So when it comes to making meaning, finding meaning in life, that's the second one. We can experience something or we can encounter someone. Love that combination. And thirdly, we can find meaning in life by the attitude we take toward unavoidable suffering. When somebody who's been in a concentration camp talks to me about making meaning by how I understand unavoidable suffering, I do try to pay attention. And I'm not advocating here for swallowing Frankl's perspective whole, but rather to pointing to this as an example of what I sometimes mean or try to represent by the word complexity. It's an example, in this context, of the overlap of science and faith. In this case, faith as explained or experienced within the framework of a particular religion and religious practice, in this case, Judaism, right? And it's led many people to ask, how does that work? Contemplative traditions in all the world's major religions place strong emphasis on exploring the inner worlds of experience and consciousness. If we grew up around Christianity, especially more conservative, theologically conservative Christianity, we might not have encountered this truth with that language. We might not have been, might not heard a lot of people in those environments saying, this practice, this religion exists to help you explore inner worlds of experience and consciousness, because that sounds too Eastern, broadly speaking, perhaps, in those contexts, right? But we would have certainly talked and heard the language of spirit in those contexts. That's the same space, different emphasis in linguistically. Science, especially the disciplines that I've named here, is also intrigued with growing understanding of areas such as thought, emotion, and subjective experience. Same space in terms of what we're experiencing there as humans. And one of the fascinating results has been a movement beyond the notion, and we're living in this age right now, we're in the thick of this, there's been this movement beyond the notion of objective third-party verifiability, right, which has sort of been one of those cornerstones of science as an idea set, is that we need to be objective and we need to have this objective verification of the results. So we've built a great deal on that, but now we're moving beyond it and we're moving consciously into the domain of subjective experience. It's generally accepted at this point that the idea of any human being a fully objective observer is indefensible. There's just no, we can't do it. And third party human also doesn't do it. It helps in that direction, but none of us are capable of being objective in the sense that science has used that notion. Which means sort of uninfluenced by who we are, right? Standing back and just dealing with the facts. We're not capable of that. So it's generally accepted at this point that the idea of being a non-biased observer is just not a thing. We all have biases and we all operate within the limits of our perceptions. Methodologically, there are things we can do to reduce the impact of that on how we measure outcomes, but we can't eliminate it. And in fact, as we move deeper and deeper into this realm in the sciences, one of the things we're learning is that it's not even necessarily a good idea to try to eliminate that. What is a good idea is to acknowledge that. Because when we acknowledge it and we invite third-party verifiability into the equation, what happens is we end up with a multivalent or multi-perspectival understanding of or view of the facts. And we see that they actually contain more than any one view could sort of elicit from them. With all of that in mind, so there's this growing and robust body of evidence, especially within the fields of evolutionary biology at the moment and neuroscience, that human choices, these are about ethics and spiritual values, human choices like unselfishness, concern for others, are not only in our best interests, individually and collectively, but they're innate to our biology. That they're the way we are as humans. And we're also increasingly able to support the ideas that the deliberate cultivation of qualities like compassion, loving kindness, attention, and calm minds are of real benefit not only to the practitioner, but also to those around them. In other words, of benefit to society. So, in terms of this exploration, where might that leave us? Well, if the canary testing for societal disintegration as a byproduct of reduced interest and participation in religion came back up from the mine without noteworthy ill effects, which the article of, that Longhurst writes in the book that he's reviewing would suggest is the case, then perhaps we could start by taking a step back from any doomsday scenarios that depend on that line of thinking. If religion is in decline, society must inevitably be in decline as well. Does not follow, is what these folks are arguing. Longhurst goes on in the article to point toward, as part of making an argument for both acknowledging that, which I think he does a good job of in the article, but also saying, and also, might this be a little different culturally in Canada? I encountered a definition of culture this past week that's, in context, it was not cynical. It sounds a bit cynical, but it wasn't in its context. Definition for collective culture as whatever we can get away with. Whatever we think we can get away with. Huh. So that's sort of the disintegration idea, right? But if we want to, if we can accept the notion that religion isn't the linchpin that keeps us from descending into anarchy of everyone just trying to get away with whatever they can, perhaps, that measurably that's not the case, then one of the possible results of that is that whatever we're exploring, we don't have to do that from the vantage point or starting from the, on the basis of fear. It's just not necessary to start there. If we make religions, we can also choose to evolve or even unmake them without fear as the starting point. So apply that to whichever one of those sort of action valences you wish, right? If we think about evolving religions, which we don't even have to like that idea to know that it happens. It's just a fact. Religions change. They evolve. If we think about evolving religions, and we think about our own religious experience, we think about what that intersection might look or feel like, what the outcomes might be, what these folks' research suggests is whatever else is true about that, we don't need to start by being afraid of what the outcomes will be categorically. We can start from a different vantage point than that. I think that's important. And if we choose not to have fear as our starting point, what might it be like to proceed with hope or even with cautious optimism? Also, if we do believe that common ground is important, and of course not everybody does, then we certainly don't need to be concerned if some or even much of that common ground is based in science. Also not a thing we need to fear. Science is, among other things, a way of making sense of the world. So is religion. And the further we travel in either of those realms, the deeper we get into mystery. And that's the realm in which we make and experience things like values and ethics. Those are very experiential. They're quite soft around the edges, but enactable. So they meet right at that intersection. And the deeper we get into mystery, the deeper we get into things that we can deeply experience, but not fully explain. And then we want an explainer story. One real possibility here, and I keep encountering this in fascinating ways in my conversations with people, because my vantage point in a lot of those conversations is exploring what we believe. It's the space that I live in. And so I often end up having conversations with people who tell me about what they believe in the course of our dialogue together. And I find myself walking away going, how can you believe both those things at the same time? To me, they're mutually incompatible, but to the person I was talking with, they're not. And one of the things that I'm learning slowly and with great difficulty, but one of the things that I feel like I'm slowly coming to learn and accept is that because both, if we want to just make this about two story sets, science and religion, very broad brush, I know. But if we want to just do that, and we have these points where they feel incompatible, we can make meaning out of both those story streams at sort of at the edge of the stream, if you will, right at the edge of the story where it carries us. The story gives us some momentum, but where the momentum carries us is into mystery. And so finding a story that helps us go, oh, that's a story that I can live with in terms of this great mystery that's part of life, whatever it is. This helps me live there. Terribly pragmatic, I know, and steps away from, but is it true, Tim? Quite radically, because again, I'm not sure that that's a defensible thing. But both of those sets of stories carry us into those spaces, potentially. So I've had conversations with people for whom, like me, they would trust many things that are about science. They would have navigated the pandemic by saying, I'm going to depend on the science, for example. But the idea of evolutionary biology, of the species being millions of years old and having evolved from a single cell, so on and so forth, through mutations, they're just like, no, like that idea just doesn't work for me. I got to have a creator, and I got to have a moment where suddenly there's humans. So that, to me, that's a blink. Like, that's where I just have to keep my neutral face on consciously in the conversation and ask some good questions, because it's true for them. They can hold those two stories together. And they do, right? So how does that work? Well, that personification of the divinity speaking things into being story is a story that helps them navigate the world of what is created. Right? Now, it's an interesting thing. Lots of us grew up being taught that those stories, we're going to talk about this in a moment, but being taught that those stories were literal. Right? That's one of the places where this stuff diverges as well. When I talk to my indigenous friends about their mythology, many of them are capable and can articulate, this is a mythology. These are our ancient stories. We're living on Turtle Island, but nobody's trying to get in a plane and fly up high enough to see the legs of the turtle. Like, this is not about a literal turtle. Right? And that's fine. The story helps me make meaning of this and helps me live better in this world. Good. That's the way a mythology should function. But many of us grew up in environments where that was not on the table. Just using the word mythology for the stories we were being taught would have been enough to get us kicked out of Sunday school. Right there, right? So, it's interesting and complex intersection. But I'm going to, again, just by way of bringing this part of our time together to a close, I'm going to say it this way. Science is a way of making sense of the world, so is religion. And the further we travel into either one of those realms, the deeper we get into mystery, the deeper we get into what we can deeply experience but not fully explain. And that, it seems to me, is a good reason to keep exploring what we believe. There's lots there to explore. Peace.